Our wild salmon are a symbol of a healthy Alaska ecosystem. So it's pretty scary when trouble appears in the salmon runs, but trouble has appeared, so let's talk about it. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. We're not going to solve the mystery of our dropping king salmon runs right now, but we'll try. Our statewide phone number, 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. We have quite a panel for you today on Pacific salmon on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Avtech is recruiting rural Alaskans for computer and network training with no cost tuition for qualified applicants. For more about the Village Internet Agent Program, call 1-800-478-5389. This message sponsored by Avtech, Alaska's Institute of Technology. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Okay, we've only got an hour, and I've got a panel that we could probably do about 6 or 7 hours of radio talk show with. So you'll have to be quick with your phone dialing at 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. And, I'll just go down through them without having everybody say, hi, nice to be here, okay, just so we can do it quickly. We have got from the Bering Sea Fishermen's Association, the outreach director, Art Nelson, who is a former chairman of the Fish Board. Karen Gillis of the AYK Sustainable Salmon Initiative. Ed Farley of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration at the Auk Bay Lab, which we now call the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute. NOAA researcher in charge of a program on Pacific salmon in the Chinook. And by telephone from Long Island, New York, Carl Safina of the Blue Ocean Institute, author of Song of the Blue Ocean and The View from Lazy Point, and a MacArthur Fellowship winner. I'm going to start with you, Carl. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thanks a lot for having me.
So I have been running a theme on this show, and you fit in with that theme, so I wanted to pick right up from there. A short time ago, I don't know if you're familiar with John Haidt, the psychology guy, and the writes about the difference in moral outlooks at the left and right wing.
I'm not familiar with him. I have heard a little bit about him.
Well, it's interesting, and I would highly recommend his new book to you because he goes down some of the similar paths of analysis that you do in The View from Lazy Point in terms of how do we get to a stewardship ethic for taking care of the earth. He probably comes to a little different conclusion than you do, but it's kind of worth looking at the analysis. But anyway, to go to what you are saying in this book, you're basically contending that we need to concentrate on the compassion part now, I believe. In other words, that our civilization has proceeded and gotten to the point where it's met itself like a snake eating its own tail. And morally, we're simply not equipped within our own cultures to take up this stewardship ethic. So it has to come out of us somehow. Do I have that fairly close?
No, well, I wouldn't say we're not equipped. I think we are equipped, but we're equipped to do various things, and some of them are completely at cross purposes. For many people, they would say that their morality comes from religious scripture, for instance, and religious scripture says certain things that are extremely important about moral obligations. It says, for instance, that you may not destroy the earth. It says that God will destroy the destroyers of the earth. It says that in a time of war, you can kill each other, but you cannot destroy the fruit trees because your fight should not be the fight of the generation to come. They are innocent. They're not involved in your problems with each other. It says all these good things. It also says things about having dominion, subduing the earth, using it up, and basically not worrying about the profanity that is the real world, because only the spiritual is important. So it says things that are really completely contradictory with each other. It's not that it's not equipped, it's that it's unfocused. And I think that in many ways our whole civilization reflects that. We are at once the most empathetic and most compassionate species. We are also the most destructive and truly the most savage species. You know, we're the only animals that not only derive pleasure from killing other things, but derive pleasure from knowing that we're causing pain to other things. So what we need to do is focus on that part of our nature that is constructive, that will result in a world that we all can bear to live in, and that will result in the continuity of the world, because what we are doing is we are running down and using up these systems that we depend on, and we're putting lots and lots of things at risk in the meantime.
Now, we can all get compassionate about, a big old king salmon or a polar bear, but maybe a pteropod, you know, maybe some little snail that lives in the ocean that has a fragile shell situation, when it gets a little less alkaline, that's a little harder to be compassionate with. You know what I mean?
Well, that's true. I mean, that's only part of the continuum that says that the basic thing is that we care most for those that are most like us. So we care most for the people in our own family. Then we care next most for the people in our communities or on our sports teams or in our cultures or in our race or in our sexual preferences, or who speak our language, or who are in our species, or are warm-blooded, or who have two eyes and four legs. And the more different from us, the less easily we can extend our sympathies, our empathies, and some sense of compassion, and some sense of, you know, just simple, really, respect for the existence thereof.
Respect. Now we're down to respect instead of compassion, Carl.
Well, those two things overlap quite a bit, I would say. Hmm. But they are a little different.
Yeah. Well, I love the way that you go through a year at Lazy Point and the various places you traveled to, and weave your argument throughout. You know, I think it's a wonderful achievement.
Yes, and I have to say that one of my very favorite places that is portrayed in the book is Southeast Alaska, one of my absolute favorite places on Earth, and the probably the only place I frequently have fantasies about moving to.
Yeah. Well, I think I want to do a quote, and I think this is from Song for the Blue Ocean, your earlier book, and sort of a landmark tome for the marine conservation field. If you're willing to reach up to the northern end of the Pacific Northwest, you can still find peerless conifer forests and carpeting runs of salmon. Options long ago lost to the rest of the world still present themselves along this coast. Options to restitch the worn and tattered ecosystem and perhaps quilt together a durable economy. And what better, brighter thread to begin to patch the holes, wholes, and to tie the seams taut again, than the silvery salmon, the fleets of fleet salmon in a fleeting opportunity for healing the whole. Not bad. So, with that in mind, Carl, I'm going to turn to the rest of the panel. I think we're going to start with Karen Gillis of the AYK Sustainable Salmon Initiative. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you, Steve.
So, you're in the same office as the Bering Sea Fishermen's Association.
Well, technically, I am Bering Sea Fishermen's Association. The executive director and the AYK Sustainable Salmon Initiative is a program within our organization. It started about 10 years ago with a memorandum of understanding between Bering Sea Fishermen's Association, the Association of Village Council Presidents, which is the regional organization for the Lower Yukon and Kuskokwim, Kowarik Incorporated, which is a Norton Sound regional organization, and Tananaw Chiefs Conference, which is the Upper Yukon. And
so you got your rivers covered with the native nonprofits.
We do.
And tribes too, I believe, yes?
Yes. We've included the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, NOAA Fisheries, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as part of the Memorandum of Understanding to really come to some conclusions or at least some direction about what's causing the trends in variability within all salmon species within the AYK.
Yeah.
10 years later, I guess there's a lot of people that would expect that we've got a lot of answers. What I think they didn't understand was that we were starting with a very data-poor area. The AYK has been chronically underfunded as far as research for years. Monitoring is a different beast, and there have been some stable monitoring programs within that area. But the research itself, it's the information that you don't get from just counting the fish that are returning to those rivers. It's the marine work, it's the juvenile work, it's the ocean mortality and the escapement quality and bycatch. Those data are really just emerging. So the initiative itself is working to kind of start peeling back those layers, and 10 years is not a lot of time.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I remember when they started the North Pacific Research Board, and a lot of the scientists who had been working on the Exxon Valdez oil spill trustee-funded projects were suddenly moved to the Bering Sea because the money was going over there. And I just looked at the globe and I realized how much bigger the Bering Sea is than Prince William Sound. There's like no comparison. You got coves that are bigger than the Prince William Sound in the Bering Sea. This is a huge body and a poorly understood body in a place where it costs a whole lot to do any kind of research. And this is also where apparently the Chinook salmon, as I understand it, spend their winters.
Exactly.
So we got a mystery, and often it's a mystery under the ice. This is pretty complicated business. There's a big ocean out there. Let's turn now to a researcher, Ed Farley of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the NOAA Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute. Tell me, what can be done? What sort of sampling and so forth do we have so far to have any idea of what is going on during those 4 or 5 years that your Chinook salmon is out there?
Well, thank you, Steve, first off, for inviting me to be part of the program. We do have a survey we've been conducting. It's by the National Marine Fisheries Service. It's the Alaska Fisheries Science Center, Hawk Bay Laboratory. Lots of acronyms go along with that. But this survey has been conducted since 2002. We're continuing all the way into 2012. We'll have a survey. We've been helped out quite a bit by funding sources such as the AYK Sustainable Salmon Initiative and others. The survey was developed to gather information to enhance our ability to understand the influence of physical processes on the Bering Sea ecosystem dynamics and to accurately predict the biological and economic consequences of shifts in ocean conditions resulting from loss of sea ice. And people say, well, what does ice have anything to do with the Bering Sea? We know that's ice covered for quite some time, especially from 60 North or Nunavak Island North, just off the Yukon. Sea ice is really a defining feature characterizing the seasonal, physical, and biological environment of the Bering Sea. And it actually has quite a bit to do with productivity. And so when we talk about what's happening with salmon in the marine environment, we need to know just exactly what they're leaving fresh water and entering, what productivity, what kind of environment are they entering. Are they going to come into a place where there's enough food for them to feed and grow and survive? And the way ice works in the Bering Sea is, of course, in the wintertime, ice cover comes through. There's a buildup of nutrients in the surface waters. It's kind of springtime. We have some melting that begins. There's some light, of course, that we light, which is important for plant growth, starts to increase. Sea ice helps to stabilize the water column, and when that sea ice begins to melt back, productivity begins. When that happens, of course, is variable each year because sometimes you've got periods of time, such as the most recent periods, where it's been very cold on the Bering Sea shelf, so ice has been present for.
Okay. Let me jump in right there because that's a very important fact. There was a project that went on to look at what was going to happen to the to the warming Bering Sea, but it turned out the whole time that they were doing their investigation was the cold Bering Sea. We've got something going on that nobody quite understands, a teleconnection of some sort or whatever with climate warming or colding or weirding. And you end up with a situation where we got more ice over in the Bering Sea side than you've got up in the, certainly in the Beaufort Sea side and also the Chukchi Sea side. So this is something nobody could have predicted, but it's something that is happening, and it certainly happened this past year. The crab fleet couldn't get out there. There was so much ice. And it turns out, I guess, some of the Chinook problem is just because the fish are late because the ice was hanging around so long there.
Yeah, so if you're thinking of the adult Chinook run this year, there is a model that's that was produced by Phil Mundy here at our Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute that examined some environmental variables such as sea ice in March and air temperatures and sea surface temperatures, and they were able to predict that there would be a later-than-normal return of adult Chinook salmon up the Yukon.
You said Phil Mundy predicted this?
Yes. Yeah,
all right.
Based on environmental variables that NOAA readily collects.
All right.
And also working with the state because there's a good time series of run timing. So if you use those variables and model that with the time series of data that the Alaska Department of Fish and Game has on run timing, you can predict based on the environment and because the model's a good model that the run would be late this year.
Okay, so we have late, but it's also kind of a weak run, as I understand. I mean, we're pretty sure, right, Karen Gillis, that this run is either Yukon or the Kuskokwim. Neither one is very good at all.
That's correct. Yes.
So the other thing about so if you're getting back to it's been cold. In fact, it's been cold in the Bering Sea from about 2007 all the way to present. But the surveys that we've been conducting started in 2002. So we were actually able to have information during a period where it was anomalously warm that we can compare with a period where it's been anomalously cold. And these surveys are fishery oceanography in nature, so we're collecting information on fish, but we're also collecting information on physical environment and some of the zooplankton that you mentioned, like the pteropods and other things. We've got nets that we're deploying to collect to see what's out there and available for food resources for fish species, and also what's available to Chinook salmon that are leaving the Yukon.
Okay, we only got an hour, and I got to jump around a little bit here. but we go to the bycatch issue. If you basically they do scale analysis, and this has been really interesting to discover where these fish are actually coming from, and they've been doing some stable isotope. Do you think there's enough stable isotope work at this point to tell us what these Chinook salmon are eating out there during the whole time they're pasturing in the Bering Sea? Because this is pretty important ecosystem wise because of the acidity. We're seeing increased shoaling of sour waters, and we know this, and we have very few measurements, but every measurement we're getting is showing it's worse than we thought it was. And we do know that if it's pteropods, they are extremely vulnerable to this.
Okay, so stable isotopes do work for determining what fish are feeding upon in terms of the level of the ecosystem that they're feeding on. But our survey, in terms of the juvenile life history stage, we We collect information on stomach contents, and we know that juvenile Chinook salmon, these are mostly Yukon River Chinook.
And these are also fish that are not where they're going to be trawled up because they're in too shallow waters, right?
Yeah, this is on the eastern Bering Sea shelf. This is their first life, their first year in the ocean. These fish are
so they're little.
They're between 200 and about 300 millimeters, or about between 8 and 10 inches. And the food that they're eating encompass capelin. So these are real small capelin, larval and juvenile capelin. They eat sand lance. They eat small herring. And in some of the years where it was warm, they were even eating these little age zero pollock, which are young of the year pollock from the spawning that occurred during winter. And I'm not familiar with what they're eating when they get older, but I do know that most of what they're feeding upon in terms of immature, that means that the first year, after the first year at sea, that they're feeding more on fish. But, of course, the fish species that they're preying upon are also feeding on the smaller parts of the food web, so those fish would be eating zooplankton. So the fish that the Chinook salmon are feeding on obviously are feeding on lower trophic levels, which include some of these zooplankton species.
Yeah. Well, I understand that, like, one of the reasons that the salmon has that red color is because of all the copepods that come in, which, you know, is very, very rich on the omega-3s. But you're saying that they're not actually eating that directly. They're eating something that's eating it.
Chinook salmon in particular pretty much prey on fish species. Other salmon species have a very diverse diet, and some, such as sockeye salmon, feed on more zooplankton and less fish. And if you have coho salmon, are more fish-oriented. To, you know, for example, pink salmon tend to feed on a variety of things depending on what's there. They're mostly zooplankton, but also fish. And chum salmon in the ocean tend to feed on tenophores, which look like little jellyfish, and also other zooplankton species. So each species has kind of a suite of prey that they're particularly good at feeding upon.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. I drowned in it. It's complicated enough that I've drowned on it. So I want to turn to explanations that people have offered. One is bycatch. One is competition for food, that maybe there's too many hatchery fish out there or something, and there's competition for food in some way. One is that climate's warming, so everybody's shifting around, which, of course, is happening. Then there's the ice, and the ice, well, what the nutrition pattern changes when the ice pattern changes, and the ice pattern has changed. And then there's radiation. The Fukushima has put all this cesium into the ocean, and somehow this might have harmed the salmon. And then there's acidification, which would affect probably what the fish eat, or what the fish that the fish eat. And so we have all those. Karen Gillis, what do you think is going on? I mean, you look at the science here. You try and represent these these people on these rivers. What are you going to say? All of the above, or where's your guess?
I am going to say all of the above.
I knew it.
However, one of the things you didn't mention is just straight harvest. You know, we are working with the result of prior years' effects. So all of those things that you mentioned, they're active, or they're new, like the, you know, Fukushima information. And so it's a compilation of effects. And when you are already dealing with a population that may be strained or in decline or in a period of decline, every one of those things is a big factor. I know, not off the top of my head, but bycatch is a really good example because it's preventable, really. Some of the other things, there's very little we can do. So
there's been every effort to do that, though. I mean, when it comes to putting chums to the side for a little bit here,
right,
and concentrating just on the king salmon, the industry is virtually in a panic about its bycatch. It had that big bycatch in the Gulf of Alaska, And nobody expected that. That just came out of nowhere. But they've been really nibbling away at it in the Bering Sea, and really the bycatch figures have not been bad in the Bering Sea. Wouldn't you say that, Art Nelson?
I agree. I mean, the high bycatch that built through the middle of the last decade, kind of culminating with the 122,000 Chinook bycatch in 2007, really dropped off quite a bit. And I think the industry and everyone was largely at a loss for really why the bycatch went so high and then at the same time fell off. It doesn't really correlate with fish abundance like a lot of people like to think. They think if you have strong runs, you're going to have big bycatch, and the same on the flip side, that if the runs are low, you're going to have low bycatch. But it just doesn't seem to work that way. What you end up with is bycatch occurring when the pollock and the chinook are just happen to be in the same place, and they're taking them as bycatch. And you're right, the industry has been in a panic about it. I think they are responsive to it, but they're out there to catch pollock, and a lot of times profit and catching those pollock is what drives it.
Well, for those who don't follow this, and only those who are avidly interested do follow it, the effort was, they thought, to have certain areas that the trawl fleet would just lay off at certain times when the fish were going to be there. Then the problem happened was that that's not where the salmon were, as it turned out. They were someplace else. So now they've gone to this sort of, what do they call it, rolling and tumbling? Or
rolling hotspot.
Yeah. Which is basically, I guess you call it adaptive management. But they talk to one another. They have a co-op and on like that.
They have a co-op. They have somebody that kind of monitors all the incoming catches from all the different boats and compiles it into reports and says, all right, based on our agreement and these threshold levels of bycatch, we're closing this area for the next week, is generally how they work it.
Yeah, and that appears to be working.
It works. I mean, it obviously doesn't zero bycatch. I don't think you're ever going to be able to zero bycatch out without closing the pollock fishery,
right.
And that's probably not a very reasonable approach to take either.
But the problem is the chum went up, and that's not related necessarily to this rolling hotspot system.
Not necessarily, but it's, to use an analogy that comes up often is, if you squeeze a balloon in one place, it's going to pop out somewhere else. And so in an effort to avoid the Chinook, and they're shifting their efforts elsewhere in time and area, and that can result in higher chum bycatch, because the chum bycatch occurs more during the summer months, and the Chinook bycatch is in the winter months in general.
All right. I want to tune back in to Carl Safina. Carl, sitting there in Long Island and listening to all this, I just wanted to get your thoughts on this.
Well, first of all, it is a confusing picture. And secondly, there are a bunch of things that can be negative and work together. And, it may not be one thing or the other. It may be a few different things combined that's causing the pattern that you see. The one thing that you mentioned that I think is probably not a factor in mortality is radiation from Fukushima. The thing about kings is that kings are declining much, much farther south than the area you're talking about as well.
But, the odd thing is, Carl, that this year they're actually stronger down to the south.
Down how far to the south?
All the way down to Sacramento.
Uh-huh. I did not know that. Yep. I did not know that. I knew that in the last 2 years there was a lot of concern about them in southeast Alaska, a lot of concern in British Columbia.
There still is. Yeah, I don't want to blow it up bigger than it is, but it's just that we got some terrible problems here to a number of runs, including Kenai River. And then meanwhile, they're doing better than they ever expected to down there.
Yeah. I think one thing about salmon that may be even more the case than in many other fish is that there is a lot of variability, and you need to look at the longer-term trends, because sometimes you say, there's a big problem. We've had a few bad years, or we don't have a problem. We've had a few good years, or everybody was very worried 2 years ago, but now they're coming back. And that variability can be can be imposed upon long-term trends of either stability or decline or recovery. The one thing I think far to the south that has been very dangerous is the tendency of people to think that the things that humans are doing that are obviously driving salmon numbers down we don't have to worry about that much because we still see good years. And they can people can tend to ignore a downward trend when they see good years happening. But the most important thing, I think, is to try to understand what the long-term trend is. What is it over 20 or 50 years that seems to be going on? And then try to look for you know, what are the reasons? The reasons are so variable. With these, many of these fish are responding to different things in different parts of their range. In some places, for king salmon, the most important thing is forest cover. In some places, there aren't any forests in their natural habitat range. In some places, ice is a big factor. In other places, they never encounter ice in their whole life cycle.
Oh, that's some of the beauty that's some of the beauty of salmon is that they have all these different subpopulations that are particularly adapted to this or that river.
Yeah, they may be the most complicated group of fish in the world.
Carl Savina, I'll get back to you in a moment, but we really do need to take a break here as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
King salmon, we all love them, and something's wrong this year. That's what we're talking about today on Talk of Alaska, and we've got Ed Farley at the NOAA Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute, who's got the research. We've got Karen Gillis and Art Nelson of the Bering Sea Fishermen's Association, and then listening to them from his perch in Long Island is Carl Savina of the Blue Ocean Institute. Carl, I'm actually picturing you in that little shack there, but I don't think you're actually in that shack that you wrote the book from.
I was headed to a different place, a little more upscale and sophisticated, but I ran into such bad traffic and I was looking at the clock and I thought, I'm not going to get there in time. I better just turn around and go back to the shack. So that's where I am.
You're in the shack. Well, okay. So I wanted to give you a chance to just throw any concluding thoughts before we get back to some of the data we have.
Well, salmon are very complicated. It's a terribly unsatisfactory thing to keep talking about how complicated they are instead of what the problem is. It's very hard to study something and get our little minds around such gigantic ecosystems. There are many things that people are doing. They're taking salmon directly out of the ocean. They're altering the ocean. There are things that normally happen in the ocean that cause fish and other populations to go up and down. So I normally pride myself on trying to get, you know, to the obvious causes. But in this case, I don't think it's really obvious what's going on.
Well, yeah, you're the guy with the petition about the bluefin tuna. So that definitely...
Well, it was very obvious what's going on with them. That situation is very simple and very quaint by comparison.
All right. Well, let's turn back to Ed Farley. Ed Farley, I understand that there is a year of missing data, and unfortunately it's the wrong year as far as our king salmon this year are concerned.
Well, our survey has been conducted, as I said, since 2002, and we have data all the way through 2011. Unfortunately, we didn't have any funding during 2008, which is, we're collecting information on juveniles. It's their first year in the ocean, so these fish are not going to come back to the river for 3 to 4 years. 2008 was a year we didn't have a survey. But if you look at the time series that we do have, from 2002 all the way to present, and realizing that these fish aren't coming back for 3 to 4 years, we have essentially six data points that we can compare. Our survey, which when I'm saying compare, I mean the relative abundance of juvenile Chinook with the number of returns per spawner to the Yukon, and this is for fish that are spawning in the upper Yukon, which is a good portion of the fish coming back in. And we find that the relative juveniles, the number of fish that we see out there per spawner, that's based on the adult fish that produced those juveniles, that there's a really good relationship already set up between our survey numbers in the late summer, early fall, to those fish that are coming back 3 and 4 years later. And the thing is then, of course, if we've got this really good relationship, then our survey could potentially be used to help predict what's going to come back to the Yukon, you know, 3 and 4 years into the future. And unfortunately, 2008 is our missing year.
Yeah. But I want to turn over to Karen Gillis here. You have a little bit of trend information, yes?
We do. Through the Sustainable Salmon Initiative, there have been a couple of very dedicated Chinook efforts. One has been a compilation of evidence of the periodic declines. And for the Yukon River, I guess specifically over the past 25 years, there's been considerable variability, as Carl had mentioned. Harvest data show a 36-year period of sustained abundance with significant declines during the past 15 years. The problem currently facing the Yukon River Chinook stocks is that most stock-specific and aggregate measures of productivity are being observed in the fifth year of a multi-year period of low productivity. The current trend of weak runs, which began in 2007 and has extended into 2011 and 12 now, have resulted from low recruit per spawner ratios. What this means is, in the absence of any fishing, the population is just barely able to replace itself, with each spawner producing, on average, one prodigy surviving to return to the river or the spawning grounds. So
that's absolutely horrifying.
The harvest population is below replacement.
Below replacement. That's what we basically have.
Right.
How solid is that?
Quite solid.
Ed, would you say that's solid?
For as far as in-river, from information, Alaska Department of Fish and Game, I'm looking at data that I believe are solid.
So, Carl Safina, doesn't that mean we just shouldn't fish?
It certainly means that the thing that we could most directly do that would have a direct result in changing the mortality rate is catching them. If you don't kill them, they don't die as fast. But the reason we don't do very logical things like that is there are other factors in play that confuse us, sometimes rightly so. And sometimes there are other factors in play where people simply don't want to give up what they have to serve a different purpose. So, we often don't do the right or the easy thing. We often don't make the difficult choices that are necessary. And sometimes there are really significant trade-offs. If you are in a pollock fishery, your main concern is probably staying in that fishery, not sacrificing your piece for salmon. And probably, since we're not exactly sure what's driving the long-term trends, you can't guarantee that if you sacrifice the pollock fishery for salmon, that the salmon will be okay in 15 or 20 years. But if there is a decline, and if part of the decline has to do with the fact that fish are dying, too fast, then the first immediate thing that people could do is to stop killing them.
Yeah, it's kind of a kind of the way the figures just plain add up. Very, very simple thing. But of course, we got a treaty when it comes to the Yukon River. We have to allow a certain amount, just by treaty, allow a certain amount of fish up there.
And you're right, Steve. However, we have not met our treaty goals to Canada for 2007, 8, 2010. So we do have a treaty, but can we uphold it? And that's not happening. And you've got...
This is worse than I thought.
You've got communities who have a very high reliance on these species, these salmon. So for subsistence uses, and these communities are some of the lowest household incomes in the state.
Right.
So you're really catching fish is essential, and yet how do you do that in this situation? So one more point about the data that has been completed by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game that I just mentioned for the Yukon, it's worse for the Kuskokwim.
Hmm.
That population is not even replacing itself. In the absence of fishing, we don't show that it would replace itself.
So how certain can we be of that?
You know, the data are strong, and they are new. I think people are really digesting what that means. Uh-huh. And for a department that technically manages people, they're in a very difficult situation.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't think they ever get enough money, and especially when it comes to research, and not to mention there's a turnover in personnel lately, so you're losing the institutional wisdom that goes back those many years. So,
sure.
Yeah, it's just a tough one. Okay, let's go to the calls here. Go first to Nicholas on the North Slope. Thanks for being so patient, Nicholas.
Hello.
Hello.
I am Nicholas Hank from the North Slope. Happy Founders Weekend. I want to let you describe our elders throughout the coast. Did you ever try getting the input from our elders? Our weather change and our tide change, maybe the salmons are just further up in Alaska North. You get input from people that probably don't even live in the coast or live in Alaska. You call scientists, that hurts to hear what they guess. It's better to get the input from our elders throughout the coast.
And well, I think Nicholas, I would never say that we could that people couldn't do a better job, but I will say I do know that the AYK Sustainable Salmon Initiative wouldn't exist without the elders. Right, Karen?
That's correct. I think, you know.
Yes. No, we can't have an input without our elders. Put our elders in the radio. Thank you.
All right, Nicholas, thank you. And thank you for holding on because obviously you really wanted to make that point. And I think we all just taking our hats off saying, yep. Yep. All right, let's go to Andy. Joins the program from Dillingham. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Andy.
Yeah, how you doing, Steve?
Pretty good.
I was on April 25th, was just in Kobe, Japan, and got to fly around Japan quite a bit. The amount of tsunami damage and devastation that's there is still phenomenal. I went to the local fish markets. All local fish are tainted. Of course, the 5-pint and the krill now is pretty obvious that they got tainted by the levels that are showing up in the fish. I've even heard of trawl caught fish in a trawl survey on the Atlee Dyson testing positive of the sockeye salmon roe and the sockeye salmon sperm for cesium-127. But I think the biggest problem with the declines in the king salmon is kind of different river by river. Of course, swim, certainly bycatch, away probably the amount of pink salmon and silver salmon that go up the rivers every year unchecked. We don't have really any information about those biomasses, how much, you know, competing those fry do for the food in the river system. And then in the sound, it seems to be the hatcheries. You've got chums and pinks that are being mass-produced by man, put into an ecosystem, and the herring stocks completely collapsed now. I mean, I was just fishing out in the sound 2 weeks ago for spot prawns. And yellowfin sole, or been sold. All you need is miscellaneous finfish, and I found tsunami debris. It's not supposed to be here for a couple of years yet, and here are big Japanese floats floating by with the Japanese writing all over them and everything.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, that's the wind. I mean, that's people who...
The wind. It wasn't calculated into the tide. But I think that there's definitely different causes. I've worked as a mate on a factor trawler. I've seen the bycatch firsthand with the best case TV cameras, and the bycatch allowable by the factory trawler fleet is more than the commercial harvest. And it's just their political strength certainly needs to be knocked down a notch. And with the CDQ groups owning the quota, you know, they're just these big, powerful fish companies now.
Yeah, but now also the CDQs are making up part of the market, which can be handy.
Absolutely.
We got processors in Bethel now that we didn't used to have processors in Bethel.
Yeah, absolutely.
It ain't all
absolutely.
Bad.
I mean, they're doing the great things are coming from the CDQ program. And just think, that's only like 5% of the resource.
Yeah.
Look at all the great things that came from just 5% of the resource. Imagine if the whole thing wasn't raped.
So you don't think that there was this empty habitat there in Prince William Sound just waiting for all those pink salmon to be put out of those hatcheries, huh? You're not buying that.
Well, there certainly isn't a food chain able to support it.
Okay.
You know, and you can tell by the decline in the herring stocks. And I mean, you don't even see herring over there anymore. And you know, when you're heading ponds and you're throwing the heads over, you should have a school of herring around, you know, prawn heads. You don't see a fish.
Wow, man, that is a telling anecdote right there, Andy.
Yeah. So I mean, anyone who's ever been out on the water any amount of time knows it's wow, something's up here. You know, and it's not the Exxon Valdez. I mean, that stuff all sinks down to the you know, backward periodic table.
All right, Andy.
Anyway, just a couple of comments there, Steve.
Very good.
And I'll listen to the rest of the show. Thanks.
All right. Yeah, thanks a lot. Anybody want to chime in here? No.
Yeah, you know, one thing I'll say is that in really anywhere that there are salmon and there are hatcheries, in a little while there are no salmon. The hatcheries do not seem to be compatible with the existence of salmon long term.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they did... Including, I thought if it wasn't for hatcheries down in the Columbia Basin and down in there, wouldn't we be even worse trouble than we are?
Yeah.
Do I have that wrong?
If you look at the big picture, I would say you probably have that wrong because in the big picture, the hatcheries in the Columbia system were used as an excuse to
I know.
Worry about what they did to the river habitats, what they did to the forests, all the dams, all that stuff. The excuse was hatcheries. But the main problem with the hatcheries is that they tend to take fish from populations that are not adapted to the local conditions, and they release them in areas where those fish have not evolved. Now, it's a lot more sophisticated in Alaska now than it was south of the Canadian border.
Oh yeah,
decades past.
Oh, you better believe it. But I mean, the fact of the matter is that the river systems, the forest systems, the whole spawning gravel and all that is the factory for the salmon, not the hatchery. That's going to make the fish that's going to go back to the river that's going to keep going back and forth. And there's no argument on that. So you don't want to. So the question then is whether the habitat can really support the at-sea habitat or wherever can support all these other fish that are going out there, given if all the other factors are staying healthy, right?
Right, and I think that has been a problem in other places. And then you have this other problem of hatchery fish that after a few generations they seem to lose the ability to spawn naturally. But then when you have escapes of those fish trying to breed with wild fish, you have a dilution of, you know, this very finely tuned system. And it doesn't really tend to work. It has caused a tremendous amount of damage in other places.
I always heard we didn't have to worry about that interbreeding because they're just so dumb that they just will never have breeding success. Maybe that's an oversimplification, but I mean, if you watch the mating behavior, it seems some rationale to it. Yeah, we're speaking with Carl Safina of the Blue Ocean Institute, author of The View from Lazy Point, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. These poor Chinook runs are definitely going to throw some research money towards looking into the causes. And the guy that's been trying to do that is Ed Farley at the NOAA Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute at Auk Bay. And Ed, if they get more money, if you get more money, what are you going to do with it?
We're going to maintain our survey, Steve. We've actually been fairly successful in leveraging some funds here from the National Marine Fisheries Service and then going out for proposals to get funding from most recently the Coastal Impact Assistance Program, and it's a partnership with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. That provided us with $2 million to continue doing research in the Northern Bering Sea and in the Arctic for this year and next year. We hope that we're going to continue that research into the future. We are always going to be seeking funds and hopefully leveraging funding from NIMS to continue this important work.
And could we use more, like, whatever, plankton trawls or something to start giving us some idea of what are the Chinook salmon eating out there during their several years in the Bering Sea?
Well, our focus is, again, on this early marine period. I believe I described this to mm-hmm. you when we talked a while ago, but there are two critical periods for salmon when they enter the marine environment after leaving fresh water. That first period is in the 1 to 2 months after they leave mm-hmm. fresh water, so they're entering a new environment. There's a whole new suite of predators. There's a whole new suite of prey that they have to adapt to start to feed upon. Really, to get around the predators, they need to grow. They need to grow fast. So that period is a period that's not being looked at in terms of survey. The near shore type research, we don't have a lot of effort going on there. The second period is that first winter at sea. So fish that grew well over that first year in the ocean during summer. They got good size, and they also need to lay down fat reserves because winter's a time when there's less food, less prey available, so they're going to go for quite a long time sometimes without eating. So our survey essentially documents the fitness of a juvenile Chinook prior to the first winter at sea. But that other critical period would be a really important period to be surveying and understanding.
And how about the analysis, the overview and publishing and so forth like that? Because that's what it seems like. There's a lot of people that really need to be delivered this information in as effective and analytical way as possible.
Yeah, we have researcher James Murphy here who's going to be publishing results from the survey. He's already produced a report. In fact, that's where I'm getting most of my information mm-hmm. from today. On the research we've been doing, the title is A Preliminary Review of Juvenile Marine Ecology of Canadian Origin Yukon River Chinook Salmon in the Northern Bering Sea. This was given to actually AYKSSI as part of an expert panel that Jim was on. And as far as the other research we've been doing in the Southern Bering Sea, we have a number of publications, especially on, believe it or not, sockeye salmon from Bristol Bay uh-huh. and also pollock.
All right. Yeah. Thank you, Ed Farley at NOAA. Karen Gillis at the AYKSSI.
Well, you know, it disappoints me to hear Ed say that he has to piecemeal funding together. And I've worked with Ed, gosh, since the late 90s or mid-90s. And that is part of the problem here. There has not been a stable source of funding. Something we have really tried to do is create this source, this pot of money that people can go to, because federal funds are few and far between. Our state of Alaska does have a responsibility here that we'd like to see them follow through on. We worked pretty heavily with the state legislature this year for a Chinook Salmon Research Endowment, and we'll work again with them next year to see if we can't move that along. I think it's a great first step, and I think it would solve some of these problems as far as what do we need to know. There are 1,000 questions, and we need even, you know, so some of those answers now.
We're running out of time, but I want to get this. Tell me, like, how are the elders incorporated into this effort?
So our organization was really generated by coastal Western Alaska residents. These people wanted an organization who could involve themselves in different levels of politics and research. And so my board of directors come from Kotzebue, Unalakleet, Dillingham, Tuxuk Bay, Emonic. They're all over Alaska.
What I'm getting from you, or I hope I'm getting from you, is the elders do have a voice in the actual direction of your project.
Exactly. My board of directors is very involved in the programs that we are implementing. And the initiative itself, the research program, has really been something that they feel very strongly about.
Carl Safina, I'm going to let you give you the last word, but it's only about a minute and a half long.
Okay. Well, I think that one of the things that we've seen where salmon exists in other parts of the world, I'm talking about Atlantic salmon in Canada, Atlantic salmon in the Northeast U.S., Atlantic salmon in Europe, Pacific salmon from where they used to range, from Central California all the way up through the Pacific Northwest. In the largest runs in the world of salmon ever in recorded history were in the Columbia Basin, is that salmon are very, very strong nations of fish, but they are not invincible. They are vulnerable. They do change a lot over time, depending on how the habitat changes and what people do. So there is cause for concern, and I'm going to try to be following this as closely as I can because I'm very concerned about it.
Well, good. I think we really look forward to any help you can give us here, all of us. Art Nelson, we never got to you, but you're going to keep watching the Fish Council and the bycatch issue, yes?
Down in the trenches at the fish fights, yep.
All right, always in the trenches. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening. Thanks to Ish Strever and Dave Waldron today. I think Josh Edge was in there for a little bit while. And next week on Talk of Alaska.
Is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects, on the web at grantstation.com. And by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Since 1985, the Benevolent and Protective Order of Elks has distributed critical information on drug awareness to children, parents, and teachers. And your local Elks Lodge has supported youth-related activities, providing direction and focus in a child's life. Make a difference. Contact your local Elks Lodge today. To find the nearest lodge, go online to elks.org. Elks care, elks share. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Elks Association. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.